Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment in China. You'll remember our best-selling video, which is on the global flood, that it has a bonus section in it produced by Brian Nickel, a chemical engineer and advocate of the flood hydroplate theory. Well, Brian has just completed production of a series of tutorials on Dr. Walt Brown's theory of the mechanism of the global flood, as the Bible refers to it, the breaking forth of the fountains of the great deep. Well, there are six great videos now freely available on YouTube, and we will embed the first video, the Hydroplate Theory Overview, Part 1, into today's Real Science Radio show page. So if you'd like to watch that, you could just visit our rsr.org website. And we're honored that Brian Nickel is joining us here on Real Science Radio. Brian, thanks for producing this very helpful series. Wow, great job.
Thanks, Bob, and thanks for having me on. It's basically the culmination of about 10 to 15 years of studying Walt's theory, and then my attempting to teach it to others basically produced these series of animations and slides, which were aids to me in helping me to teach without having to do a lot of technical discussion and hand-waving.
And the animations are very helpful. You've done some amazing work at communicating. As an engineer, you do a really good job of communicating what could be complicated ideas when we could see them visually. So what I'd like to do is talk through part one of your six-part series. And if we could begin with, sort of midway through part one, you discuss the evolutionary view of Earth's formation. Could we start there? Because if the audience could get in their mind how the atheist, the secular, let's say theistic evolutionist, how they believe the Earth formed, when we take that model and we compare it to actual observations we make today, the two are in conflict. And so that's sort of a good introduction then to the biblical model and the hydroplate theory. So how do the secular scientists claim that the Earth formed?
Well, there's many differing views as far as how it steps in which certain elements were brought to the Earth. But supposedly about 4.5 billion years ago, asteroids gravitationally collapsed into each other. And the energy released from these impacts produced a molten liquid Earth, which remained molten for millions of years. I think about 200 million years is the current guesstimate.
So magma, liquid rock, when it comes up on the surface in a volcano, we call it lava. So those asteroid collisions or those planetesimals, those rocks that were orbiting a young sun, they're crashing into each other. In all those collisions, that produces a lot of heat.
Yeah. Tremendous kinetic energy produces a lot of friction when they hit. And that's the theory that would have produced a molten Earth in the evolutionary view.
And how long would the evolutionary view claim that the Earth was primarily molten?
What I've read and seen in my research is that the current view is 200 million years of molten conditions.
Okay, so the Earth is liquid rock, magma, and whatever water happened to be in this mass that became the Earth, and whatever minerals happened to be in this mass, I'd like to ask you about those things, because today on the surface of the Earth, we have a lot of granite forming the continents, and we have a lot of water, not only on the surface, but deep into the Earth. So if the Earth was molten for hundreds of millions of years, first of all, what would have happened to the water?
The water and really every element involved in this molten mass is going to gravitationally settle according to its density. So water at the temperatures of molten rock is going to be a gas, and you know, all accounts would be that it should escape to the surface. And of course, the denser items like rock and what should be in the middle are, you know, should be basically sorted gravitationally
In gold, for example, gold is a very dense element, so gold should sink, yet we find a tremendous amount of gold in the surface of the earth. But to stick with the water that you mentioned, water would basically be forced to the surface, and if the earth is molten, that water is going to evaporate. So our atmosphere, I would think, would have the most severe greenhouse gas is H2O, water. So what would the atmosphere of the earth be like if there was all this water on the surface of a molten earth?
Well, you'd have a runaway greenhouse condition that would trap solar heat in, and it'd be a very humid atmosphere, and it'd make life on Earth impossible just due to the heat.
Mm. And runaway greenhouse effect, in other words, it would get terribly hot and it would stay that way.
Right. As far as that gaseous atmosphere, it would remain very hot because of the water content contained in the atmosphere. And already it being a molten condition, there wouldn't be much chance for things to cool down.
And then I mentioned, as is in your video, granite. Granite is a really neat, special rock. And they have not been able to reproduce granite in the lab, the large grain granites that we see in nature. So could you tell us why they can't produce it? I mean, other minerals we could produce by taking materials and putting them under pressure and heat, but granite we can't make. And so why is that? And then how do you make granite on a molten earth if the earth is molten for millions of years? So why can't we make granite in the lab?
Well, granite is made up of four main sub-minerals, and those sub-minerals, mica, hornblende, feldspar, and quartz, those minerals individually they're different densities. And so they too, in this gravitational molten environment, will sort according to their density. And so you would have a layered cake pattern and not be able to grow the large intermixed crystalline grains that you see in granite that makes your granite countertop felsula.
So that if the minerals that became granite, if they had been part of this molten earth, you would not find them in the distribution that they are in, let's say, a cubic meter of granite. They would be sorted out by their specific densities. Gravity would sort them out.
Exactly. In a molten state, those elements, those minerals would sort gravitationally according to their density, the denser elements being at the bottom and lighter elements being on the top. So they would produce a layered cake pattern, not intermixed.
What we have noticed here on Real Science Radio, we've been on the air for 25 years with Bob and Yurt Live, and we've been covering science, do a science show once a week for many years, and we began 25 years ago with many science segments on the program. And what we've noticed is that the evidence against the secular origins claims, it's not little tiny mysteries, it's not small observations here or there, it's everything. And so granite defies a molten earth, and yet, what is there, a little bit of granite on the earth, or is there a lot of granite?
Well, if you look at the geology textbook, most of the continents are made up primarily of granitic rock.
So I would put that in the category of there being a lot of granite, so that it makes up most of the continents. And their origins theory that the earth was once molten can't explain the granite that we're all building our homes on and driving our cars over the continental crust. So then there's the matter of not only the water that would have been squeezed out of the molten earth to the surface, but the observations we make today, Brian, we're finding deep water deep below the surface of the earth, and in fact, much further than physics would be able to explain if, in fact, the earth had been molten originally. So could you talk to us about deep water?
Sure. Deep water under continents is not expected in that if you imagine a block of soft modeling clay and you stack that up really, really deep, such that it was so deep that at the bottom of that column of clay, the clay at the very bottom would compress out, and we would expect that to compress out. And the more clay you stack on top, the more clay at the bottom is going to press sideways rather than straight down, because the clay is being compressed beyond what it can support.
Is that called its compressive strength?
Yeah, you've exceeded the clay's compressive strength, and so it responds by expanding sideways or flowing sideways.
Like if you had pudding, chocolate pudding, and you tried to make a big pile of it on your plate, there's only so high it's going to go before it's going to start to squish out at the bottom.
Exactly. And in fact, if you've ever made stovetop pudding, you leave it in the fridge overnight and you come back in the morning and you look in there and there's cracks that have opened up in the middle. And yet those cracks don't open up all the way to the bottom of your pan. They open up only a certain amount. You're seeing that that has been exceeded.
The compressive strength of the pudding. Right. And so now rock, the surface of the earth, it's not made with putty or with pudding. We're talking about rock, granite. And granite has a certain compressive strength to it. But now how does that relate to the question of how deep should water, surface water, be able to seep down into the earth?
Well, clay is easier for us to imagine compressing. I tend to use that initially as an example. With granite, its compressive strength is around 23,000 pounds per square inch. That works out, when you take into account the density of granite, you would have to pile granite about 5 miles high before the granite at the bottom would begin to press out in similar fashion that you see with clay.
Wow. And so the crust of the earth, it varies in its thickness, but let's say where it's 30 miles thick, then if it's going to exceed the compressive strength of the rock after 5 miles, once you get below 5 miles deep, there are not going to be any cracks opening up for the water to seep down further into the earth.
Precisely. You would not expect to see any water below 5 miles, just simply because you can't even at a microscopic level form a crack. The compression is all around and in every direction at that level. Mm. And so there's no way that you could have an opening down that deep. So it would be very surprising to see water lower than 5 miles if the scenario that the evolutionary theory presents is correct.
So before then, we get to observations of how deep can we find water below the surface of the earth. Maybe we could take a moment and give a thumbnail sketch of Walt's hydroplate theory. And that's a bit difficult, but we call it Walt Brown's theory. But it's actually what the Bible says at a very surface level. The Bible talks about the fountains of the great deep, that when God made the earth, that there was a tremendous amount of water beneath the surface of the earth that came up during the global flood when somehow the crust cracked. And so when we go back and look at Genesis chapter 1, God says that he created the earth and it was covered with waters, the deep, and then he made the firmament to divide the waters below from the waters above. And many have seen that that firmament was the crust of the earth, because it's called the Rakia, God Raka, the crust of the earth. And the Bible says that God Raka the earth above the waters, that he made the earth above the waters. So when you take all that into account and many other verses, we see that when God made the initial earth, he put a layer of water, subterranean chamber of water, deep below the surface of the earth, by Walt Brown's theory, about 60 miles below the surface. And about how thick was that chamber of water, Brian? How deep was it?
The estimate currently that Walt has placed on the thickness of the granite was about 60 miles thick of granite. And below that, a low-end estimate on the thickness of that water trapped below the granite shell is about 0.9 miles.
0.9, so almost 1 mile deep of a subterranean chamber of water. If the Earth was originally molten, and all the water would then be forced to the surface, and we'd have a runaway greenhouse effect. But we didn't have a runaway greenhouse effect. Even the evolutionists acknowledge that, the atheists. And granite would have a very hard time forming. In fact, it seems it would be impossible to form because of all the different minerals in granite. But then the water that could not seep back down into the earth, if we find water deep below the surface of the earth, that seems to be consistent with a biblical description of how God made the earth and that the fountains of the great deep broke forth and flooded the surface. So could you talk to us about deep water? Is there water deep below the surface of the earth?
Yes, there is. In fact, two of the deepest man-made boreholes into the continent have found water deep and very deep, below 5 miles. That
you show those drill projects in your video. One is in Germany, the other is in Russia. And Germany's is called their KTB project, and Russia's Kola Peninsula dig. And the one in Germany is 5.7 miles deep, and the one in Russia is 7.6 miles deep. So 7.5 miles down. It's an amazing technological accomplishment to drill that far into the earth. That's astounding. But then when they did that, what did they find? Did they find what they expected to find based on the evolutionary view of the origin of the earth?
Well, the goal of these projects was to reach the mantle and to discover what exactly the mantle was made out of, like what type of rock, what type of minerals were in that rock. But they didn't reach their goal. They didn't ever get to the mantle because they encountered so much more heat than they ever expected in these drill holes of 5.7 and 7.6 miles deep. Instead, to their surprise, they found very hot, cracked, fractured granite. And inside of those fractures was salt water that was 2 times more salty than today's ocean water is.
And with Walt's theory, about half of the water that is now on the surface of the earth was in the subterranean chamber. And as that water, which your video gets into, became supercritical because of the energy, the work that was put into the subterranean chamber, that water got extremely hot, supercritical, and it began to erode the chamber, the ceiling of the chamber, the floor of the chamber, and it was loaded with minerals. And during the global flood, that water came up and mixed with the surface waters. And so we have our oceans today, our salty oceans. But for that water to be not only salt water, but for it to be there at all when water shouldn't be able to seep below 5 miles deep from the surface, you said this was surprising to these geologists, not only that they found water down there, but it's salt water, and it's in fractured granite, because granite shouldn't be able to fracture at those depths.
Right. You would not expect there to be fractures. It's very difficult to explain why there are fractures at all at that level, and then why there's salt water in those fractures is even more surprising.
Mm. And so we could make a prediction based on Genesis chapter 1 and the flood chapters 6 through 9, and then also based on Walt's hydroplate theory, that if you repeated these efforts on other continents, you would find something very similar. You would find 7 miles deep, or deeper if you can get there, you would find fractured granite and water.
Yes, in fact, there have been global measurements of all the continents, and they find what they believe, the researchers who do these measurements, find what they believe to be salt water, porous salt water deposits underneath the continents on all continents around the globe. So this is a condition that I believe is a remnant of the fountains of the great deep, which are referred to in Genesis chapter 7, especially like in verse 11, where it says that all the fountains of the great deep burst open on the same day. Mm. And I believe that what these researchers are finding is the remnant of that collapsed chamber that used to be there. That used to be the great deep.
Genesis chapter 7, verse 11. In a few minutes, I'd like to ask you about some of these verses. I jotted them down as I watched your video about the way God made the earth upon the seas and the storehouses of the deep. But first, in New Zealand, they had quite a project to try to map what is below the surface of the earth. And typically, geologists have waited for earthquakes, naturally occurring earthquakes, and then they look at the seismic waves that are generated, that are measured by stations they place around their country, around the world. About a month ago, I installed on my cell phone an app called MyShake, and it uses the accelerometer in the phone to detect earthquakes. And as more and more people download this app, and it really, it just sits there on your phone. It doesn't bother you. And it's only paying attention when you're not holding your phone, like when your phone is stationary on a tabletop, a desktop. And then if there's an earthquake, they will find out from thousands of people's phones all in a region how strong the earthquake was. So that's pretty amazing. That's a great app. And in fact, it might help with early earthquake warnings in the future. Maybe one day there will be millions of these seismic detectors on our cell phones around the world. But in New Zealand, they did something different. Could you explain? They didn't just wait for an earthquake to happen to measure the seismic waves.
Right. I believe the earthquakes produced very long seismic wavelengths, and the researchers in New Zealand were looking to get a more clear picture of what's down there. And so they did it artificially using explosives to generate a short wavelength seismic wave. And that gave them the clearest picture. And what they believe they're seeing down there is a subducting plate, which we've all been taught. Plates subduct and they dive down underneath other plates that are adjacent to them.
That's the plate tectonics theory that we've covered on this program now and then.
Right, and about all you have to do is wait about a week and you'll probably see it on either PBS or Discovery or History Channel. You'll see the scenario played over and over again. The mantra of plate tectonics is that plates subduct under other plates.
And if someone goes to our website and adds /subduction, they can hear an interview that I did with Dr. Walt Brown on the topic, and we looked at all the powerful observations that show that subduction does not happen. So that's rsr.org/subduction. But in New Zealand, they think that they're going to see subduction. So that's what motivated them to set off these explosives and to monitor the seismic waves. So what did they find?
So to their surprise, they found about 50 miles down, a 6-mile thick channel containing melted rock or magma again. And also, they believe it might also have be mixed with water. And so that, again, 60 miles down, they're finding deposits of what they think are water. Hmm. And that's, again, completely surprising to the scenario where Earth was in a molten state for 200 million years. And at its beginning, we would expect water to be at the surface and at the most 5 miles deep.
And if we could go back to that for a moment, because obviously this evidence is extremely consistent with the hydroplate theory. And this was just published in the journal Nature in 2015. So as we see, in fact, we've stated on this program, all scientists work for Walt Brown. They all work for Walt Brown because in so many different disciplines, they make these astounding discoveries, and time and time again, they just scream the hydroplate theory. They just say, Walt is right. Walt is right. The findings that shock them because of their secular origins models are consistent with the biblical creation account and the global flood.
Yeah, I believe that there are research screens that Walt's theory aligns very well with what their findings are. However, as you and I both know, none of the researchers themselves are screaming Walt is right.
But no, that's
I think
right.
that it really does show that
right. Exactly.
This theory has something. Walt has done just a monumental job of identifying these things and correlating so many different aspects, not just in his field of mechanical engineering, but in many fields. And this is a multi-physics problem, and Walt really has a knack for being able to pull all of this together and make sense of it.
We describe him as the Isaac Newton of our day, Walt Brown. And I think eventually when history looks back, or when the Lord looks back and helps us understand Earth history, we'll see that Walt really has opened up an understanding of so much of not only the Earth, but the solar system, our environment, the environment of the Earth, the origin of Earth's radioactivity that you've done a fabulous video on. The heat that the Germans and the Russians encountered as they're drilling and trying to get to the mantle. You said it was unexpected. If the Earth was molten, then eventually, after billions of years, the heat transfer equations, it should have cooled down by now. It should have cooled down a long time ago, and so that we shouldn't have a liquid outer core, magma as the outer core down in the center of the Earth. It shouldn't be there. It should have cooled down by now. So a secondary assumption by the atheist was that, well, that's from radioactive decay, but the magma that comes up from the mantle is not bringing radioactive material with it. And so geologists generally accept that well more than 90% of the Earth's radioactivity is in the continental crust, and specifically the granitic continental crust. That's where almost all the radioactive elements are. So the fact that they found so much heat as they're drilling down through the crust, that shocked them, because in their model, that shouldn't be there.
Right. In their model, they believe that, of course, a tremendous age of billions of years. And so the Earth was, in their scenario, was only molten for the first 200 million years of its existence. And then as the planets vacuumed up all the asteroids, there was no more impact that were producing more kinetic energy. So the heat transfer into space over time would have started to harden the shell into solid rock. And so we really do not expect to see deep water according to that scenario.
So no deep water. And on top of all that, in the news this past month, terrible earthquakes. And about 10 years ago, I was in a debate on the age of the Earth against an opponent, John Nickel, who was the former president of the EEGS, the Environmental and Engineering Geophysical Society here in the U.S. And what a debate. We still sell the debate, their side, reasons to believe, the Henry Ross chapter here in Denver, Colorado. They never wanted to sell the debate. It went very well for the young earth creationist. But one of the comments I made to John Nickel was that, in fact, he asked me, he said, if you young earthers are right, then we geologists should be giving governments greater warnings about earthquake risk. So do you really think we should do that and tell the governments that the risk from earthquake is greater than that we predict from our old Earth assumptions? And I told him, Brian, of course, I told him, yes. Yes, we should be giving much more serious earthquake warnings. Well, since then, since that debate, there have been the Sumatra earthquake, magnitude 9.1, northern Sumatra, 8.5, off the coast of Japan, 9.0. We have had about 750,000 people killed in earthquakes, 750,000 since that debate. And you compare that with the horror of 9/11, when 3,000 were killed. 750,000 thousand since our debate in 2004. So if the Earth is billions of years old and it was all molten, you would think it would be way more stable by now.
Right. That is another indicator that the Earth is not as old as is being claimed. And I had also meant to wrap up a conclusion there, that the Earth, if it's really 4.5 billion years old, according to the scenario, then by now it should have almost completely solidified. So exactly like what you say, we shouldn't have probably earthquakes or a molten outer core or all this magma, because by now the Earth's crust and the materials in the Earth should have long since solidified.
Yeah, and we have earthquakes that are so deep that they stun the geologist. So we should not have earthquakes that are as deep. Brian, do you recall how deep some of these deepest earthquakes are?
They're hundreds of miles down.
Yeah. Yeah. Another powerful piece of evidence consistent with the hydroplate theory. So, Brian, we're out of time, and we've only gotten halfway through the discussion that I was looking forward to. Is it possible you might be able to join us for a conclusion of this?
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Well, that would just be great. I want to thank you for your time. That's Brian Nickel, mechanical engineer, and he has produced a series of videos on the global flood and the hydroplate theory. They're on YouTube. Of course, you could find his channel by going to YouTube and searching for Brian Nickel. That's B-R-Y-A-N, Nickel, N-I-C-K-E-L. And if you want to add hydroplate, that might make it easier, but his channel pops right up. And you could go to our website, rsr.org, and we will embed part one of Brian's video series right there on our website. So this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams in Real Science Radio. May God bless you.